Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Chair of the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's co-host. We're going to be talking with Ellen in a few minutes about the new writing she's done on the reinventing of banking, including new developments from Russia, Iceland, the UK, and Ecuador, where we see how technology is opening new paths for creating and managing the credit of economies, and how these new forms of digital currency are playing out with the people, and what they may offer those who wish the creation of money to return to the public and away from the prevailing monopoly of creation of money by private banks when they make loans. Ellen will be speaking with Scott Smith, who is running for President of the United States as an independent, who has a three-point plan that will eliminate income taxes, pay off the national debt in 5 years, and completely restructure the banking system. Big ambitions for sure, but they're from a person who has the experience and credibility to make it a serious proposal. We'll be getting to that interview later in the program. But we're also going to spend a moment in discussion with an executive who this week found it necessary to get out of the business of providing credit services to the underbanked as a result of regulatory harassment. The historical track record of the National Credit Union Administration seems to conflict with the idea that they're there to help their industry. Matt Stannard will be along shortly after that with a look at our 2015 Top 10 Bankster Stories. But now, let's talk with Ellen about how banking, money creation, and credit relations are being transformed by the power of digits internationally.
Well, what I was writing about was Russia, Iceland, Ireland, and the UK, and Ecuador. But Ecuador has already implemented it, and what's pretty interesting about Ecuador is that they have done an all-digital currency. They're sort of the mirror image of most countries, where in most countries, it's the government that issues the cash. And so cash has historically always been the money of the government. Like, if you go back to the U.S. Constitution, originally it was just coins. The Constitution says Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. Well, that was the constitutional power, and that was the official currency, because they were afraid of paper money because the Continental had collapsed. Mm-hmm. So the paper money were just promissory notes that were a sum owed in gold, and the banks were supposed to have that gold on reserve, and mm-hmm. you could come and cash it out at any time. So that was at the beginning of this country, and then by 1850, coins were 50% of the money supply, so that was like half created by the government and half were banknotes created by banks. By today, we're down to 0.5% is coins, and about 3% is coins and paper dollars. And all of the rest is created by banks when they make loans. And in Europe, they're actually talking about going all digital. In Sweden, they've gone pretty close to all digital. So in Ecuador, they're also going digital, but in the opposite way. Ecuador has issued the U.S. dollar. That's their official currency. So they do not, the government does not issue their paper money. It comes from abroad, and they have to get these boatloads of cash in. So the government has sort of turned the tables on this system, where they are now issuing a digital currency, which they call dollars. They say these are digital dollars. They're equivalent to dollars, one-to-one. But this is actually the government-issued money, the digital currency, whereas the paper money is paper dollars. And what's interesting is that the central bank is the lender of last resort. all the citizens of Ecuador can have an account directly with the central bank because of this digital money. So they can just have it right on their cell phone. It's real easy to open an account, and it's an account with the central bank. So that then dovetails in with my interview this week, which is Scott Smith, who is running for U.S. president as an independent. And he also, I just thought it was really interesting, his plan would include a central bank to which everyone basically had an account. So the central bank would be where the banks would get their money instead of getting it from deposits. In other words, having to worry about liquidity and capital requirements and reserve requirements. They can't go broke because they are backed by the central government. They are an arm of the central government or an agent of the central government. He has some other really interesting proposals too. So Ecuador has already done that. And then Russia, because of sanctions, we basically are controlling the Russian central bank, at least according to some of the high officials there, which I'm going to write another article on that because it's too much material to put in my current article. But it's pretty interesting. He's saying, that particular official is saying that it's the Western banking system that has this tourniquet on them and that they need to have their own central bank. They need to break away from the Western banking system. In 1992, the West, in effect, won the Cold War. It's like with Iraq, you know, where we set up our own central banking system, or like we did in Libya, et cetera. When you win, you go in and set up your system. So that's what we did in Russia. And the head of the central bank, some people are calling for treason, and it's a woman. But Putin has not actually come out and criticized her publicly. So that's all pretty complicated, but pretty interesting. And then in Iceland, they're talking about going to, I mean, this is just a proposal, but there are actual politicians backing it, that they would go to the Chicago plan, which is that only the government can issue money, that banks cannot create money on their books as loans. So banks would, in effect, become mutual funds. Their loans would be actual loans of other people's money, as people think, and the people would know that their money was being lent, and they would get a decent interest rate for it, and so forth. And then in Ireland, we have a thriving public banking movement. So my concern with the Chicago plan is that it would radically reduce the amount of credit available. But if you combine that with the public banking movement, where you have publicly owned banks, they would then, like in Ecuador, they would actually be arms of the government. So their profits would go back to the people. It would be a sustainable system. So you would still have the availability of credit through the banking system, but the banking system would be public, publicly owned.
So money would be issued interest-free?
Well, it would be interest-free to the government, yes. If you're making loans to the government, you would still be making private loans at interest under the Bank of Minnesota model or the Sarkozy model. But the Russian model is actually, you know, what they're talking about in Russia is actually interest-free. So that's another interesting thing. It's sort of the Islamic plan.
So could you overdraw your account in Ecuador? How does overdrawing your digits look? What does that look like?
You still need loan officers, and you still need to go to the bank to get a loan. Well, in fact, they still have private banks, of course, in Ecuador. It's just that the private banks have now been enlisted to use this digital money. So it's sort of like Bitcoin, but instead of being a private digital currency, it's a publicly owned digital currency. So you can take your U.S. dollars, your paper dollars, which is what everybody uses in the villages and so forth, you can take those into any bank or financial institution, and they will turn it into digital dollars, which you can then use on your cell phone. So where here we have like 25% of the population is either unbanked or underbanked. They don't have bank accounts. There, you can instantly set up a bank account on your cell phone, and it's an account directly with the central bank. So you don't have to worry about them going bankrupt. They've always got the funds. But to get a loan, you would still need to go to the bank and show your creditworthiness and get approved and so forth, and it would still be an interest. You know, their private banking system is still the same.
When we're talking about digital currency on the last show, we're talking about maybe investing in mattress futures to be able to hold on to your cash. Now it sounds to me like we should be investing in smartphones.
Well, yeah. Everybody has them in Africa, apparently. You have that same system developing in Africa, but not to the extent that...
But it does depend on a link that way, doesn't it? And when we think about digital currency and people, you know, fantasize about the convenience of it and the application of it, it really is a risky path, don't you think, insofar as the control is left with the bank managers of your credit and really the government as the holder of the keys to your account?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it certainly is if you don't trust your government. And nobody does today, so in that sense, it's risky. But in Europe, for example, I would be more suspicious of the European Central Bank. They're the ones that are trying to go all digital. It's not the governments. The governments have been squeezed out of the whole market. If it goes all digital in a private banking system, then it's actually the banks issuing the money, not the government. But if you had a government-issued digital system, that does sound quite a bit safer. And, of course, cards are very convenient. I mean, overall, it's probably more convenient to use cards than to worry about those coins.
Yeah. We had all had talked about how in Sweden there are signs that say we don't accept cash, and that would be new to Americans, certainly. But in Germany, we had we're in our conversation today with one of our colleagues at the Sparkassen, realized that everybody in Germany insists on cash. They don't like to take cards, and that their tradition or their pattern of reliance is on hard cash.
Right. The bus system here going into the flyaway, going into the airport, only takes credit cards. And they're a public bus system. I don't know how they get away with that because you would think that paper money is legal tender. Why do they not take it? But they don't. The argument is, I guess, that they have to have somebody sitting in that little kiosk thing 24 hours and they don't want to get broken into by...
So if you don't have a debit card, you walk?
Yeah, or a credit card. And so when they first implemented that, a lot of people were quite upset because they were counting on getting to their flight, and they got there and they didn't have a credit card and they couldn't get to the airport.
So there's another related issue to this that bears discussion. That is the notion of sovereignty. The primary sovereign right of a country is its ability to issue its own currency. And now the trend seems to be that the governments aren't doing that. The banks are through private lending. Any comments or any thoughts about the implications for sovereignty or the likely trend of it? I mean, are we simply seeing sort of a fait accompli where the banks and corporations have become supranational entities that can really cut us off?
Well, that's certainly, like with the TPP, that's the direction we're going in, and that's what everybody's afraid of. That's why the Ecuador thing is a little bit interesting, because they're reclaiming their sovereignty. They're saying... We can issue our own digital money. Of course, they've said that they're not going to use this for the budget, that it's only for payments and it's only to facilitate trade. But we know that digital money is what makes up most of the money. You know, that entries in bookkeeping entries are what most of our money consists of. They don't consist of paper or coins. So they can easily expand the money supply just by expanding the velocity of money through this digital system. And the government has control. So... To me, I'd rather see a central bank controlled by the government having control than to have private banks headed by an effectively private central bank. I mean, you can argue that these central banks are technically owned by the government, but they're considered independent. They're not controlled by the government. They don't respond to what the government wants to do.
Yeah. I guess the even overriding concern is that Kim Jong-un will, as Dick Cheney has suggested, might explode some bomb over our stratosphere or whatever and screw up all of the electronic signals and put us all out of business. It's a frightening notion, but it would seem that would be a real vulnerability, that all sorts of electronic failures or systemic failures in electronics could really undermine the whole currency structure and system.
Yeah, agreed. And I can't imagine that they'll ever actually eliminate cash, but I kind of like the idea of a digital currency where we actually have an account at the central bank so that we don't have to worry about our bank going bankrupt or doing a bail-in and taking our money to recapitalize itself. You don't have to recapitalize the central bank because it's got the power to create money.
Yeah.
And in Ecuador, there's no way that they're going to go all digital, because right now it's mostly still all cash. The digital is just sort of an experimental thing, but it's catching on. The people like it because it is convenient.
Well, when I say we'll see what happens next, it sounds like this is happening, and it probably won't take very long for this to be, you know, widely adopted.
Things are changing.
Okay, so let's see what your guest has to say.
Okay.
Before we get to Ellen's conversation with her guest, Scott Smith, we want to spend a moment on a story that broke this past week in the New York Times about a credit union in New Jersey that was dedicated to serving the credit needs of the underbanked and undercapitalized, but that is now getting out of the business altogether because of harassment by the National Credit Union Administration. I spoke with Jordan Modell of Internet Credit Union.
You're the CEO of the Internet Credit Union, and you guys are preparing to do kind of the unheard of, to return the charter that you worked hard, that you waited 18 months to get. You're going to return it to the National Credit Union Administration. Why?
Because they wouldn't allow us to serve the community in any way, shape, or form that would have made it possible for us to even just break even at all. And unfortunately, they've forced us to spend three times as much time, and literally I can prove that, dealing with the regulators and the examiners than serving our community. We've tried to work with the regulators as best we possibly could for years now, and then it just became evident to us they will never allow us to serve our community by allowing us to offer the products and services that community would like, and that at a certain point in time, you needed to be able to break even, and they wouldn't allow us the time or resources to do that.
What was the mission of the credit union?
We were established to go after those people left behind by the banking system, those people who were underserved, underbanked, and underdocumented, the three unders. So an underserved person is someone whose credit may not be good enough to be able to get, open up a bank account or try and establish credit. So what we did for those folks was we actually established programs whereby they had things like shared secure loans, which was a way of building back up your credit rating once your credit rating was run down. For the underdocumented, we actually went out and started a program called the ITIN program. Now, an ITIN is an individual tax identification number. A lot of immigrants get taken advantage of by the system. Someone comes in and they will sell them a Social Security number for upwards of $1,500. They will take that Social Security number, which is a fake Social Security number, and go and work in an entry-level job. And they may actually, as we found out, work for 7, 8, 9 years on the same Social Security number, which does not attach to their name. Mm-hmm. And then when they go apply for a path to citizenship, they will find out that they got no credit for all of those years for all of the taxes that were paid. So we started a program called the ITIN program, great expense to us. Mm-hmm. And again, we had to abandon it because we spent all of our time with these two particular examiners, and all of our efforts and money, we weren't allowed to do any of the other products that we wanted to do. And on the underbanked, the issue there was, for example, we worked with the local Catholic Church to try and provide low-interest loans for people to complete their education, right? So if you're underdocumented, it's very hard for you to get a loan from a conventional bank. And we were actually willing to do that. And we found our first test case was this one kid. It was his senior year at Rutgers. He needed $8,000 for tuition. He had an excellent credit score. He had been working. He actually had a job. Anyone would have given him an $8,000 loan just so he could complete his education. We went to the NCOA and we asked them if we could possibly, because we were only limited to loans of $5,000 or less. And think about how, those are the riskiest type of loans possible. We asked them if we could do that, and they said no. So there went our reputation in the community. It's you know, mm-hmm. as in all communities, your reputation mm-hmm. is everything, right? And if you can't fulfill what you try to fulfill, then you are just, you know, your reputation is shot in the community, and it completely blows another chance for you to at least break even, to be able to serve the community further.
So what's your sense of why this this antagonistic attitude toward minority lending is evolving?
Well, if you look at the history since the NCUA in its current incarnation was founded, right, there are, I think, on average 300 credit unions that are closed a year and only two that are open. Or I'd say overwhelming majority of that is basically folding small credit unions into larger credit unions because they're easier to deal with and they're safer for the NCUA, and they can spend less time regulating them, which is the antithesis of all of our minds of why credit unions were founded. Credit mm-hmm. unions were founded, to my mind, for being microfinancing, right? So that you can walk into the credit union and they know your face, they know your issues, right? And they try and help you. The credit union, unlike big banks are designed, right, for you to be a number. Because it's the only way they can deal with all of the, I'm giving everyone every benefit of the doubt, right?
Right.
You know, they're designed basically because they're centralized. You're a number, and you're your FICO score, you're whatever the number is behind you, and they make decisions based solely, pretty much based on that. Right?
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying that's sort of the fact for life. I worked for big banks for many years. What credit unions are designed for is to try and find some way to help you. Right? If they possibly can, and it makes financial sense at all to do it, they will try and find some way to get you a loan, get you an account, help you out, build your credit. That's what they were designed to do, not to be banks. Credit unions are credit unions, banks are banks. And in reality, quite honestly, banks should be thrilled if credit unions were everywhere because they're serving a community the banks weren't really designed to serve. And so that, to me, is the saddest issue right now, because all these small credit unions are being regulated out of existence right now.
That was Jordan Modell, CEO of Internet Credit Union, which is currently handing its charter back to the National Credit Union Administration out of frustration and being hamstrung, leaving the public service that they were dedicated to serving. It's noteworthy to observe that prior to the introduction of the federal agency, there were almost 24,000 credit unions in America on the front lines of lending credit to communities. Today, there are about 6,500. Well, don't look now, but it's that time of year, and Matt Stannard's going to help us take a look back at what we've been through with the banksters this past year.
I'm Matt Stannard with your public banking report. 2015 is coming to a close, and that means somebody has to do what I'm about to do. Try to line up what were the top 10 stories this year concerning public banking, the malfeasance of Wall Street and big banks worldwide, and reasons for hope. Here goes, but don't kill the messenger. This is only one person's attempt to make a list. Your top 10 public banking-related stories of 2015. Number 10, class action for interest rate swap fixings. In November, the Public School Teachers Pension and Retirement Fund of Chicago initiated a class action suit contending that 10 of Wall Street's largest banks have extracted billions of dollars in monopoly rents year after year by fixing interest rate swaps. They're accused of colluding to prevent the trading of interest rate swaps on electronic exchanges like the ones on which stocks are traded. Number 9. The Trans-Pacific Partnership threatens public and democratized finance. Despite massive protests, exacting analysis, and a president who promises to listen to the people, the TPP passed congressional approval, and that has us concerned, particularly concerning our investor dispute settlement provisions that could be used against public and postal banks, calling them anti-competitive because they attempt to correct the structural flaws and gross injustices of privatized finance. But hang on into 2016, folks. We're still fighting this. Number 8. The Bank of Canada case survives all the procedural hurdles put in front of it. A small group of Canadian citizens is suing the Bank of Canada, which used to be one of the world's largest public banks, before monetarism and neoliberalism turned it into a lackey for international financiers. A lot of people thought the Canadian government would file a bunch of procedural motions and get the case dismissed, or get the plaintiffs to back off. None of that happened, and the Canadian courts are now ready to hear the substantive case. Number 7. Chicago public school crisis. A derivative time bomb in the hundreds of millions of dollars led to the closing of multiple schools and the draining of the education budget in the Chicago public school district. That's right, Wall Street gambled, literally gambled, with Chicagoans' school money. And they lost it, but their agents still got rich. The teachers, students, and families of Chicago, though, they got nothing. Number 6. Jeremy Corbyn and quantitative easing for the people. Big old labor, the kind spelled L-A-B-O-U-R, is back in Britain. But the ideas Jeremy Corbyn is touting aren't all that old. One of them, quantitative easing for the people, takes advantage of banks' ability to create money and calls for using that grassroots form of stimulus. Critics say that causes inflation, but that's not correct. The economy needs to be running at productive capacity for that kind of inflation to occur. We know Corbyn is open to some new and outside, out-of-the-box ideas. Let's hope Americans are too. Number 5. Resistance to austerity in Greece. Despite the stubborn bullying of the European Central Bank, the hypocritical and sanctimonious positions of Germany, who've benefited from more bailouts than any country in Europe, and the weakened position of the Syriza party, the people of Greece aren't going to take austerity lying down. They know they didn't create the crisis they're in, and they'll be damned if they're going to pay, and pay miserably, for other people's mistakes. They're still protesting as I recite these words. Number 4. Postal banking. Thanks to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign and a great new book by my friend Mirza Baradaran called How the Other Half Banks, one of the best ideas to hit the beltway in a long time has made a comeback in 2015, banking and securing payday advances or small loans through the post office. Oh, but what will those high-interest payday lenders do then? Maybe they can open up malt shops by the postal banks. Number 3. Racial redlining by banks in Detroit and Baltimore. Last month, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition released a study demonstrating that banks are prohibitive in their mortgages to black residents in the Baltimore area. Meanwhile, in Detroit, as if they didn't have enough bank-induced problems there, black applicants were 6 times more likely to be denied a mortgage due to poor credit than white applicants, due in part to a strange loophole in the Community Reinvestment Act. Haven't our cities suffered enough at the hands of big banks? Number 2. The LIBOR scandal. In May, 5 big banks pled guilty to manipulating international exchange rates and national currencies, ruining millions of lives. The federal government made them pay paltry fines. Nobody went to jail, and there's no serious threat to any of those banks' profits. In disgust, California's Santa Cruz County declared it would not do any business with the guilty banks. And number 1, the number of states with public banking initiatives all over the country. These include New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Washington, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Illinois, Maine, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, and more. Some of these states have bills in their state houses or general assemblies. Some have city officials committed to feasibility studies and planning. Others have local candidates committed to creating public banks if they win. But this has never been a busier time for the public banking movement, and your support helps make it happen, along with the excellent model of the Bank of North Dakota, which after nearly 100 years continues to fund public goods and help that state weather financial storms that plague the rest of the nation. So really, you are the number one story of this year. Happy holidays, and remember, it's our money.
My guest today is Scott Smith, who is running for president in 2016 as an independent. So are 230 other people. But Scott has a unique platform that I got quite excited about when I read his book, and he has the credentials and the experience to make it work. He has built a number of companies from the ground up in a variety of industries, including finance, his field of expertise. In the 1990s, he was an early pioneer in structured finance, developing the model for conduit financing. On the strength of his idea, his firm secured a $1 billion line of credit, and his model was rapidly adopted by Wall Street and used for securitizing many forms of debt. Later in that decade, Scott formed a firm to help structure the financing for President Nelson Mandela's redevelopment program, which helped provide affordable housing for some 11,000 families. He also founded Kids Magazine with a readership of millions. So it's great to be talking to you, Scott.
Thank you, Ellen. It's very good to be on your show.
So you have a three-point platform to totally eliminate income taxes, pay off the national debt in a mere 5 years, and completely restructure the banking system. A very ambitious plan. I read in your local paper on the internet, Smith's promises are extremely attractive. However, his nigh outlandish economic claims risk inspiring incredulity in voters, which could cause people to simply not believe him, whether his proposals are rooted in solid economics or not. I actually do believe you after reading your book, but I wanted to lay some groundwork for our listeners. What particularly convinced me was that you devised this securitization scheme that rescued the banks from the savings and loan crisis, the thing that Jimmy Stewart had a problem with, and it's a wonderful life of borrowing short and lending long. So I wondered if you could go into that and generally into how you got where you are today.
Sure, yeah. You know, as you get older and you get old enough, you begin to realize that our economy goes through cycles. You don't get so excited when it's crashing, and you don't get so elated when it's skyrocketing, because you know it's only a matter of time and it's going to change direction. And that was a period in which I had developed very good relationships with a number of banks and savings and loans, and I was an underwriter. I would put together packages for commercial real estate loans. So if you're buying a shopping center, you're refinancing an office tower, I was a go-to guy, and I would help you structure your next deal. And when the S&L crisis came along, I'd really been tracking the health of the S&Ls and the congressional laws that were changing and impacting it. And I have a very strong opinion as to how it occurred and why it occurred. But nonetheless, what happened was I was left without lenders for all of my borrowers. The federal regulators were telling banks and S&Ls, divest of your commercial real estate loans. They were saying to all lenders, don't lend anymore. In fact, get rid of those loans you've made. And, well, there's no one to get rid of them too. And you could just see the crisis mounting. And so I thought if there was a way that I could collectively take a group of my borrowers together and form what I call the pool, $200-300 million of loans in that pool, and structure it appropriately, we could go to Wall Street and we could sell bonds to provide the money for these borrowers instead of going to the bank. And I love the numbers on it, because when I started analyzing what would our cost of funds be, you know, in other words, what would the mortgage rate be for these borrowers, we could really do it for about half the cost for a 5% interest rate versus a 10% interest rate. And that would make for a safer loan, more conservative mortgages, and better for the borrower as well. So my structures on it were spot on. The rating agencies adopted it, and they introduced me into the banking community. And it was DLJ, later sold to Credit Suisse, who provided us with the $1 billion line of credit. And we were very successful at doing the loans in this fashion. And we had them all guaranteed, each of these pools, with good underwriting, very good underwriting, and a cash reserve for what we underwrote the risk to be. And they were literally bulletproof for years. And what happened is that eventually led to oversight on the banker side, and you know, people tend to get too excited about things, and they would loosen up on the parameters and eventually introduce credit default swaps to replace these cash reserves. As far as I was concerned, that's the beginning of the end, because you need sound underwriting. But what did impress me about the whole thing is we were able to basically step to the side of the banks and create something replacing the bank's role in a large measure, and produce something that was better for investors and better for borrowers at the same time.
That's great. It reminds me of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, where Roosevelt mm-hmm. was not able to get the Federal Reserve to cooperate. And so they just set up the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which wasn't even a bank. But basically what it did mm-hmm. was, like you did, kind of securitize loans. I mean, they sold mm-hmm. bonds to anybody, including the Treasury. And the Treasury, of course, bought most of them, I guess. But sold mm-hmm. bonds and then made loans that were good loans to rebuild the, you know, it was all, they were called self-funding loans, which meant that they picked things that mm-hmm. would pay back, like whatever, yeah. roads and bridges and farms and dams and things that were productive.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually turned a profit and rebuilt the entire country. And it wasn't the banking system that did it, and it was a public entity that did it. So anyway, I guess mm-hmm. that leads into your three-point platform plan, one of which is to redo the whole banking system sort of in that way. So do you want mm-hmm. to go into that?
The way I look at this, in some ways, my proposal is fairly radical. It's pretty out there. In other ways, when you look at it, it's really a simple flipping of a few switches.
mm-hmm. And it seems to me that anything that's not radical, in other words, just tweaking the existing system, they've tried everything and nothing works. And they're
right.
admitting that yeah. now, that the whole system is flawed. Then no matter how you tweak it, you've got a failed
I
system
agree.
On your hands. So we need to do what you call radical, but it's kind of one of those
right.
things where if things are so complicated, that can't be the answer. It's got to be
right.
that we're seeing the sun rotating around the earth, and when we figure out that the earth rotates around the sun, we've got it all solved.
Right. Yeah. So the infrastructure is in place. It's a matter of changing some key aspects of the system. And I do agree, it will require something that's substantial in nature, because I think our current system is sicker than people realize. I think it's more flawed than people realize. And I do think we're heading into a brick wall a little faster than people realize. And when you're at the top of an economic cycle, it's a little easy just to not pay that much attention to it. But then as the economy will downcycle eventually, it will get our attention in a big way. And we do need to do this. The banking 2.0 is what I call the rehaul of the banking system. And it's a simple observation that we grant the Federal Reserve the right to print money, and there is really nothing wrong with a true central bank creating the money that we use. That's the purpose of a central bank. That's not radical. There's no real issue with that. But what I suggest is that we use that central bank to directly print the money that the commercial banks lend out, that we scrap the fractional reserve lending system, and that the bank itself, the commercial banks, what we consider to be a bank, J.P. Morgan, Citibank, Anytown Bank USA, think of it as a doorway or storefront to the Federal Reserve. The money is created within the Federal Reserve, that the bank is the service agent. It's merely the one that does the underwriting, that services the loan, does the foreclosures on the loan. It does all the work that it does today, but it's not lending out its reserves or a multiple thereof. It's lending out on behalf of the central bank. And that central bank is owned by us Americans. It is our bank. You know, we are the shareholders, stockholders, and owners of the bank. It is serving our purposes. And therefore, the commercial bank, well, they would earn their service fees, an origination fee, and a servicing fee for servicing the loan. But no longer would they be charging us interest for the loan, nor would the Federal Reserve necessarily charge any interest. If we did charge interest on loans, well, the dividends would come back to us, the people, anyway. But I think it's a more efficient economy if we actually don't charge any interest at all there. Today, we think of interest as something that is necessary in order to convince somebody to lend their money to you. And the way we have the system set up, yeah, that's true. But the way I'm proposing the system, it is the job of the Federal Reserve to supply that money, and so no one needs to be induced anymore.
My one issue with that would be, how do you limit how much people can borrow then? Is it sort of like your credit card where you have a credit limit? And I mean, it seems no reason to pay it back if you can just keep renewing it year after year. You'll say, well, I thought I was going to make it, but I didn't quite make it. But if I could just have another year, I'm just quite sure I can get it.
Yeah.
I mean, it reminds me
of
my kids.
I'm with you on that. And I'm actually, as a banker, I'm fiscally very conservative. Okay. So the lending parameters have to be very tight, and they have to be conservative. In fact, what's interesting about that is if you look at the parameters for a residential loan today, they have what's called the front-end requirement. What percentage of your salary is it okay to go to a loan? And it's around 33%, say a third of your salary. So if you're making $100,000, you can spend $33,000 on your mortgage, or $3,000 a month. So lending parameters, in my mind, go hand in hand, and the penalties for not paying back, foreclosures and all that, you don't get rid of any of those. Maybe you tighten them up a little.
But interest is sort of a penalty for not paying. I mean, you like with credit cards, if you paid the first month, it's interest-free. So really the interest is just a penalty for not making the deadline, right? It seems to me people would just say, well, I don't need to pay it because they're not coming after me, so I'll just keep putting it off.
Yeah, so for a mortgage, for example, that's a fixed payment that you have to make each month, and if you don't make it, you lose your house, okay? But same thing for a car loan. So any sort of collateralized loan, the penalty is you lose your collateral if you don't make your payments. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But now, that seems a little harsh, too. I mean, what if you almost made your payment but not quite? Wouldn't it be more fair to let them pay a little interest and keep the house or the car?
I'm sure there's a balance there that you need to do because you're dealing with human nature here. My main point when I'm talking about interest is when you're looking at making money off of money, just the interest as an inducement in order to have enough capital lend out, you can avoid that whole problem by having the Federal Reserve being the source of the money that the banks lend out.
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of like the idea of the
interest going back to the government as a form of tax in place of income taxes. But then you have another solution to that, which is very interesting. So.
Yes, the tax piece is the piece that usually the way I present my three-point platform is you start with taxes because, hey, that's the biggest impact on people. Then you look at the banking piece because that's the second biggest impact on people. If you're able to cut the cost of housing for people in half, they're way better off. With taxes, it's rather shocking what you could be doing that's different. If you look at some of the calls for a flat tax today, what people are kind of getting at is let's have as broad of a tax base as possible. Let's get rid of a lot of the write-offs and things like that exist out there. So we have as broad of a base as we can, and therefore the tax rate will be low. And there's nothing wrong with that math, but the problem that we have when we're looking to income as our source of tax is the best that tax base can be. It's around $15 trillion. These figures are a couple of years old, but we have about $15 trillion in income each year. And, of course, our goal is to collect just about $4 trillion for government spending. So there you have it. That's around 25%. So when somebody says the flat tax would be 10%, that's with a deficit, And then the idea is, let's grow the economy to the point there is no more deficit. Well, that's kind of pie in the sky and hopeful thinking. And so my view was, let's look at alternatives. And so a lot of talk lately about the financial transactions tax, the FT as it's called sometimes. It's been used in a couple of places. And, it's kind of a first thing that people turn to because they read about the New York Stock Exchange and the American Stock Exchange, and it looks like lots of money moving hands. And why not tax that instead of income? Well, it is a bigger bucket than income. It's, $50, $60 trillion. It's a lot of money. And you compare that to 15, it's maybe you're quadrupling the base. but you'd still be talking about a tax rate 5-10%, and that's too much to tax the New York Stock Exchange. It won't function that way. What I look at is a broader base still, and technically would be called a financial settlement. It's also called payments. Anytime somebody gets paid, okay, so I write you a check, it's a payment. Was it a gift? Was it income? Doesn't matter, it was a payment. So payment is sort of a very generic way to look at it and say, well, what if you tax an entity, a corporation, anything, every time it receives a payment? How many payments or how many financial settlements are out there? Of course, a lot of that, there's no way to keep track of it. You know, it's under the radar. But if you look at the highly regulated companies that do financial settlements, the ones that are very much under the control of government today, that figure is $4,500 trillion. And that's, again, a 2012-2013 figure, so it will be higher today.
$4,500 trillion is 4.5 quadrillion, right?
Yes. And those are the ones that are reported through the Federal Reserve to the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, that keeps track of those figures for all the major nations of the world. It's reported in the Red Book, publicly available, clearly delineated in all the tables, fascinating tables to look through to see exactly where all that money is being moved and from whom, you know. But if
so,
you were
is
to
that
tax,
U.S. though, or is that global?
No, that's just the United States.
Wow.
Now, if we impose the financial settlements tax, my analysis of it, modeling of it, is that financial settlements would increase. The tax rate would simply be 0.1%. So you look at a family of four. Today, you're paying $20,000 to $25,000 in taxes. Under a financial settlements tax, you'd be merely paying $100. Today, with an income tax, when you're paying that $25,000, you got a $500 billion deficit. With a financial settlements tax, when you're only paying $100, you actually have a $500 billion surplus. I don't think there are many propositions out there that are such a win-win.
I know Bernie Sanders is promoting a financial transactions tax, which might mm-hmm. be a little different, but the same general idea. Mm-hmm. So that idea is out there right now. Mm-hmm. It's in the news, very topical. Mm-hmm. And I've seen objections that it would totally kill the repo market, and it would kill the banking system as we know it, because they do these overnight deals where what they make on it is less than 0.1%. So the tax mm-hmm. would actually eat up any profit. So you wouldn't get anybody willing mm-hmm. to lend, mm-hmm. and that would close mm-hmm. down our whole banking system. Your answer might be, we don't need the banking system because we're doing it a different way. But that's one possible answer. But also, so what's your response to that?
Well, Bernie, he's going in a good direction, but he's doing exactly what other people have done when they propose financial transaction taxes. They're looking to Wall Street. They're looking to the stock exchange itself. That's the entire scope of reality out there. And if you're limiting it to a tax on the New York Stock Exchange, that's not a big enough bucket to make a difference. All you're going to end up doing is adding one more tax to the system. You're going to use it to augment income taxes. You're not replacing income tax.
It would kill the overnight lending scheme.
Well,
right?
They do not. Those don't appear to go through the normal financial settlements. And in fact, when I was going through tallying up the financial settlements reported in the Red Book, where I arrived at that figure of 4,500, I skipped over the New York Stock Exchange. I didn't even include that figure in there. And so the repos, they should not be in the figure that I am using right now. So we would be okay.
Well, it seems a bit of a shame to skip over the stock market. Cause, I mean, 0.1% is not going to break your ordinary trader at all. But it seems like somebody must be paying. Who would you be hitting up the most?
That's a dear subject to me.
All right.
I remember being out on Wall Street and seeing some of the demonstrations on the Occupy Wall Street movement. And a bunch of young kids out there primarily. and they're demoing. And I'll be honest, my heart went out to them. I'm like, I don't think you guys are real far off here. I mean, and I'm a Wall Street guy. I'm one of the ones, as I'm driving down in my black car down the road, they're pointing at me as one of the evil ones, you know. And there's this sense that they had that there's an awful lot of wealth out there and the distribution's not really going to the right people. And so out of that movement, there came this theme of, you know, the 99% and the 1%. And so I had, you know, a number of friends who were pretty well-to-do, you know, and they would always feel like they're part of the 1%, you know, and a lot of these guys are against me. And so as I've done my research and dug into it, I'm very fond of saying to my wealthiest friends, saying, no, you're not in that upper echelon. It's really not 99 to 1, it's 99.7 to 0.3. Okay, so if you look at what I call the material economy, that's the salaries you and I get. It's the cars we drive. It's the houses we live in. It's the transactions that people are involved in, the average people are involved in. That's also the gross domestic production and income. Both those numbers are, you know, $15, $17 trillion. That is the world as we know it, is that $15 trillion. The world as we don't know it is the other 4,500 trillion. And so in some ways, this would be the most appropriate tax of the uber rich if everyone was really being taxed on payments and settlements. The tax rate would only be 0.1%. So your fair share earning $100,000 is $100. If you take $100,000 in income, for every $100,000 in income, whether it's earned by you or a couple of people together, for every $100,000 in income, there's 30 million in these transactions that are not taxed. The ratio out there is a little more extensive than people think.
Mm-hmm. And are these trades where they're actually speculating, or are most of them speculation? I mean, I know I've heard that about the currency trades.
Currency trades dwarf this, okay? So we're not even getting to that yet. That's a little harder to tap into. I didn't go there. It's more liquid and more able to move around the planet. You know, you're not mm-hmm. saying this is what's happening in the U.S. as much. And it is, it's very speculative. These trades, you may have heard people say the ultra wealthy benefit out of volatility, the movement up and down in markets. Mm-hmm. In fact, you can make a good case that every time the markets go down and then move back up, that shift in power, that shift in asset moves a little more, you know, towards the ultra wealthy. And so the types of trades that are going on that are included in the 4,500 trillion, the asset value, you look at it and you say, okay, it's the ultra wealthy who are going to lose here, okay? And granted, they would be taxed more. If you're listening to the show and you think you're in the ultra wealthy, you're not probably. Okay? If you look at would they really lose, the key is you look at the value of the underlying assets that are being moved and traded here. And in an economy that was income tax free and you had the additional consumer spending that swept out of that, and you had the rise in the gross domestic production, and you had the rise in the value of securities, the increase in the value of the assets would far outweigh the 0.1% for the tax on the movement of the assets back and forth. So even the subjects that might be taxed more under this would actually make more money on the end. Likewise, you've heard of inversions where corporate money is kept offshore, legally so. You know, Ireland, Cyprus, there's many these tax haven types of countries who've developed a system that makes it favorable to bank and keep your money there. It's a great business from a sovereign point of view. So the net result is a lot of our multinational, our U.S. companies doing work in other countries. That money never gets back to the U.S. They keep it out of the U.S. because it would be taxed at a higher rate. But a financial settlements tax of 0.1% is far lower than the rates in the tax haven countries, and that's why that money would come flooding back in, and the actual volume of financial settlements in our country would increase if we put this tax in place.
That is pretty amazing. Wow.
Yeah. The way I look at it, this is sort of my guiding principle. You look at day-to-day life. You look at what we think of our economy being, and that's the quality of the car you have, the clothes you have, the food you have. We all participate in that economy, okay? Money was an invention meant to facilitate that economy, to make it easier to do trade, to easier to earn money. It is a beautiful invention. It's a marvelous invention. However, as we got better and better at producing things, more people began getting jobs in the monetary economy, unrelated to production. And as we did that, we began to develop a financial system. There was more to stoking that monetary economy and facilitating that, and we forget that the whole purpose of the monetary economy was to augment the material economy we live in. And we have these rules that developed that served transactions in the monetary economy, but they ended up harming the material economy, and it's an artificial barrier we put in place. Income tax is a great example of that. We're just taxing the wrong thing. And there's no great surprise, and it's nothing to be ashamed of, because as our economy has matured over centuries, it's always changed. It's always evolved. And you can always go back to history and you see the tail end of any old way of doing things. It was always painful at that stage, and people were kind of tearing their hair out saying, what do we do? And you move into the new paradigm of doing things. You move to that next level that facilitates growth in your material economy where you live, and it sort of springs forward, and you realize you never needed all that pain. There was just a new way to do it. Right now, it would be a godsend to us. It would work very well. It would cause an enormous amount of production in our material economy. We'd all be wealthier because of it.
Yeah, the obstacles would be getting past those people who fund politicians, you know, the big money players, like you said, the 0.3%. So if we can make a case that, like you said, they would actually make more sales.
Frame it as a win-win. It's, you know, the main obstacle right now is just ignorance, resistance to change.
Well, and if people realize that we're killing the planet and we all have to live here, it is this whole thing about the Earth going around the sun. When you realize that you're looking at it upside down, you know, and we can fix all this to make a system where everybody's happy and it's a one big beehive where we're all working for the same thing.
Ultimately, wealth in the monetary economy is only valuable if you can translate it into the material economy in the end. You know, thank God that we have our technologies. But we're just not capitalizing on that right now. We're using an old-fashioned system.
An old-fashioned gold-based system where people still think that money is a thing that's scarce and that you have to borrow it from somebody else. But that's not what money is today. It's just credit. It's just an exchange between people. Well, this has been really interesting. It's been so great talking to you. Do you have any sites, things you want to point people to?
They can go to scottsmith2016.com. What I want to do is spend my time and effort educating and evangelizing for this and looking for a way to move it into mainstream discussion so that it's part of the national dialogue and it gets to the stage that people go, oh, I get it. Why aren't we doing it?
It's been really great talking to you and good luck with
you,
your
Helen, for
campaign. I hope you really can get out there in the public eye.
I do too. We'll see how it goes.
Okay. Thanks very
so much.
My guest today has been Scott Smith, who is running for president in 2016 as an independent.
That does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. If you'd like to stay current with Ellen's writing and commentary, visit ellenbrown.com. And if you'd like to know more about public banking and related developments around the country, please visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Visit them on Facebook and follow on Twitter at Public Banks Now. Our thanks to our guest today, and especially to our committed sponsors at Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services, dedicated to economic justice and fairness and the creation of new American public banks. Payment Management offers complimentary analysis of your current credit card needs and expenses at paymentmgmt.com. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!